Borders, Bandits and Baby Wipes, A Big Adventure in a Tiny Car. Vasim Tarasi scaled Mount Kilimanjaro, trekked to Everest, navigated New Zealand's Great Traverse and hiked in Patagonia, but it wasn't nearly enough. Inspired and challenged by his quests of getting there, Bassam and his two friends signed on for the infamous Mongol Rally, a nearly, and get this, 10,000-mile road trip from London to Mongolia through terrain that would make, and it says here, a mountain goat's knees buckle in a vehicle that was little more than a go-kart. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the States, author of Borders, Bandits and Baby Wipes, Bassam Tarasi. Bassam, good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Well, good evening to you guys.
Good afternoon to us. I mean, you've done this sort of thing before. You like to sort of strike out and live a life less ordinary, shall we say, Bassam. But why the London to Mongolia rally?
You know, I kind of thought it was the closest I'd get to like a real Shackleton moment, you know, to see what I'm made of. And I don't know, I thought it was the first time I couldn't spell Azerbaijan. I didn't know how to say Kyrgyzstan. I didn't know where Kazakhstan was exactly. So I thought it was, hey, this is my probably first and only time to check out Central Asia and to have a story to tell when I'm old and gray.
I can understand that, but normally sort of people take on these sort of treks. 10,000 miles is an awfully long way. My father famously raced from London to Mexico via South America. He had a rally team behind him and a state-of-the-art car in this 1970. You had something perhaps a little more basic?
A little bit more basic. It was a 1997 Daihatsu MOVE.
Oh, blimey.
This had 42 horsepower.
Right.
847 cc's. I think my favorite stat about the car is that a Porsche 911 Turbo could do 0 to 60 to 0 three times before our car could go 0 to 60. which puts a lot of things in perspective.
And that would only be if it fell off a cliff, probably, as well.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
So, I mean, exactly. You and two friends decided to get this together then. What sort of preparations did you make, and how did the other competitors look at you?
Coming from the States was a bit of a challenge. It was about 11 months of logistical prep, reason being we had to procure a car in England while not living in England. And so needing to do that legally. So had to get it registered and insured, and what address are we using, and how are we test driving the car, and all that stuff. So I think there was a bit of a tip of the hat to the American teams. There was only maybe five to seven of us. Most of the teams were from Europe. So we met our car about 6 days before the rally started, whereas other teams had months and months to prepare their car and test it and fix it and all that.
And when you actually sort of stepped, you know, and you saw your noble steed that was going to be carrying you and two other people, presumably, and you're based in the States, you're used to a certain size of car. A compact in the States is about the size of a limo over here. What on earth did you think?
I remember my mate Greg, he's about 6'3", he played rugby and all that kind of stuff. He looked at it and he said, I don't know how we're going to fit anything in here. And it was a bit daunting. I mean, in the book, I say we had to use some Tetrisian effort to fit everything in the car. You know, you're removing the seat, you're reshaping a bag to see if it can slide in. I mean, in essence, when you were in the back seat, it was a mini coffin. I mean, if you were claustrophobic, you'd be out of luck, because to the right of you was just a stack of everything all the way to the ceiling. And you got to think, you had tents and clothes and pots and all sorts of things that are clanging around in the car. So it was a bit nervy. The good thing about a Daihatsu MOVE is that it's very tall, so you don't really feel scrunch in the car, but it's narrow. I said it's like an Audi A4 on its side. That's what a Daihatsu MOVE looks like.
Right, and then you hopefully wouldn't put the Daihatsu MOVE on its side. To just tell us a little bit about the rally, because it's not a motor race per se, is it? It's more sort of getting there is the part, rather than you weren't thinking of coming first.
That's correct. So it's the brainchild of this company called The Adventurists. They're based in the UK. And their whole philosophy is, hey, we've gotten soft as travelers. Everything's too easy. You know, you have all-inclusive trips and all that kind of stuff. So their idea is, hey, we need to break down, get lost, and figure it out. So it's not a race per se. I think the award goes to teams who can simply finish. And that was our goal, to finish within a reasonable amount of time so that we were still employable upon return.
What was the, how did it sort of pan out then? Do you go off? I mean, they don't just say, right, leave London, take a left at Dover and then keep going until they start throwing things at you.
No, they basically say, leave London and we hope you get to Ulaanbaatar. Basically you're on your own. There's no support system. There's nothing. So the beauty of it is some people can choose. I mean, we call it the Mickey Mouse route. You can go through Northern Europe through, I think it's Poland, Lithuania, Russia, and then pop down into Mongolia. But that's highways the whole time. So that's not really fun. What's the point? So the big decision typically is you get to the Caspian Sea and you have one of three choices. Go north through the Ukraine and you need a dual entry Russian visa. Go south through Iran, or go across the Caspian Sea on an industrial ferry. And that's known as the northern, the southern, and the central route. And that's where the fun begins.
Right. Okay. Now, we beg the question here, and the listeners will be agog. Which route did you decide to go for then?
Well, naturally, we chose the central route because finagling our way on an industrial ferry out of Baku, Azerbaijan, trying to get to Turkmenbashi, Turkmenistan, is way more fun.
Of course.
So that's the route we chose.
As a point here, I mean, how did people react to you? You're all sort of, you're sounding extremely American on this line we've got here. You're actually half Palestinian, half Dutch, aren't you? And I've just checked out your Twitter picture and you have a magnificent beard, so in one of the pictures. So how did people react to the three sort of you guys turning up in this tiny car?
You know, it was a mix. I would say for the most part, it was sheer curiosity. I mean, we were almost rock stars on the highway, people beeping their horn, waving, what are you doing? In places like, I remember in Ashgabat in Turkmenistan, we were in a supermarket and we could have been from another galaxy. I mean, people just followed us in the supermarket, completely confused. But I think there also was a sense of pride from a lot of people that you had three people from the States who were traveling through their country, who were curious enough to explore and check it out. I think my favorite line was from, we were in Kazakhstan and we were in a traffic jam and a gentleman beeped his horn and he asked us to roll down the window, said, where are you from? We said, America. He said, where are you going? And we said, Mongolia. He said, Mongolia? But there are no roads in Mongolia. Now, mind you, about a week before we said we're going to Kazakhstan, people said Kazakhstan, but there are no roads in Kazakhstan. So it's kind of all relative. We had people in Kazakhstan looking at us completely confused, wondering how the hell we were going to get to Mongolia in this tiny little city car.
Now, the book is called Borders, Bandits, and Baby Wipes. I'm not quite sure if I really want to hear the baby wipe stories, but it is the afternoon here after all. The borders and bandits. I can imagine that perhaps crossing a border in Central Asia can be, in the former Soviet republics, can be quite an entertaining and time-consuming business.
Absolutely. I think that was the every stress point of the trip, always surrounded around borders, right? Did you have the correct visa? Did this border guard want to let you through or let you out? And no matter how many stamps you got, no matter how many yeses you got, if that last guard at the last gate holding a machine gun didn't want to let you through, you didn't go through. So that was a bit challenging and testy, especially because we had a roof rack with a cargo carrier. And when the guard said, open everything up, take everything out, well, the next hour of your life was removing everything from your car, everything from your cargo carrier, and then somehow having to reattach it in this Rube Goldberg kind of way to make sure everything was tied in and secured. And so, yes, the borders were a lesson in patience, in relentless patience, I would say.
There's a wonderful word that we have, and I'm sitting in my studio. If I look to my left, I can see across the Straits of Hercules to Morocco. And there's a wonderful word that we have over in Morocco called bakshish, which is basically greasing the palms, or we call it enchufe in southern Spain. Did you have to sort of occasionally bring out, I don't know, a couple of candy bars or something like that, just to make sure that you traveled smoothly?
Yes. A few times, leaving Turkmenistan, going into Uzbekistan, there was definitely an exchange of candy and goods. One of the things, maybe the best lesson to know when you're traveling through Central Asia, buying a carton of cigarettes, whether you smoke or not, is a wonderful gift to have.
Right.
Azerbaijan became our most challenging country our bottom of the barrel moment. That's where bandits came in. That's where cops who needed to be fleeced came in. That's where a fixer who tried to abandon us came in. And so it became a bit of a calamity. But, you know, that's part of the story.
Did you have what we can refer? Could you was Azerbaijan? You said you had we refer to it as a Wizard of Oz moment. We're a long way from Kansas here, Toto.
In the book, I actually use that line.
Really? Like,
we're not even exact. I say something to the effect of, "We're not even near Kansas anymore." that was the. And you know, it's tough. You're driving between, no joke, between like 11 and 14 hours a day. And, you know, potholes left and right. Your headlights look like they're immersed in honey. Like there's, you know, they barely work. And so you're constantly on edge. Every day we said, okay, here's the rule. We're never driving at night, right? Everyone agree? Right. And then every day we found ourselves driving at night because of traffic or road closure or whatever. And so that tested the wits for sure.
I mean, how did you plan? Did you plan your route from the safety of the state, saying, "Okay, so we're going to stay at the Marriott Uzbekistan, and then I hear they've got a great place with a pool somewhere south of, you know, Kyrgyzstan," or did you just, because you couldn't sleep in the car? So, I mean, what was the sleeping arrangements like?
Right. Well, being an engineer by trade, you know, I like logistics, and I thought I had it all figured out in advance. But as they say, you know, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. So I had these plans of, well, we're going to get to here each night. We're going to get to here. Didn't really work. Most of Europe, we were able to find hotels or something of the sort, relatives in Holland, et cetera, et cetera. Past Istanbul, it was more, let's see what happens. So a lot of camping. So you have a tent. So I would say half of our journey from London to Ulaanbaatar was in structures with roofs, and the other half was camping wherever. And sometimes it was literally pull over into this dirt patch. Doesn't look like there's any farmers that are going to poke a hole in our tent, and let's just pitch our tent.
And how do you deal? What goes through your mind apart from that Kansas moment when you suddenly realize that you have been surrounded by bandits and you are a long way away and you feel incredibly American?
I think the dangerous feeling in moments like that is nobody wants to be taken advantage of by anybody. And the scary feeling is when you're hungry and tired and it's, you know, over 35, 38 degrees Celsius, 100 degrees. You're willing to do some reckless things in your brain. So I think at that moment, it's pure self-preservation and you feel like you don't want to be taken advantage of, with always balancing, well, I also don't want to die. I don't know if this person has a gun or a knife on them. Like how much do I care about these $20 or $40 or $80? So those were the tough moments of wanting to stand up for yourself, but then also realizing, hey, I'm in a land where the rules aren't the same, so I just need to find a way to get through. So sometimes it was a seesaw, and we used each other in the car for, hey, how should we handle the situation? Sometimes there were arguments, sometimes they were yelling, sometimes there was people reaching in our car wanting money, and you figure it out without getting killed.
Yeah, that's supposedly the thing to get through the day with. I mean, apart from avoiding having to sort of bribe officials and whatever like that, was it pretty much a case if you're driving for 12 to 14 hours a day, you know, watching the countryside go past you? Were you just in awe of the experience? Did you have a killer playlist? I mean, were you arguing over the map saying, I'm sure that was the third turn to the left and we're going to end up somewhere we shouldn't be? For goodness sake, stay clear of Syria. I mean, how did he go around it?
Exactly. I mean, I would say a little bit of all of the above. I mean, there were those moments where the road just allowed you to unleash your mental ball of yarn and you wondered about your place in the universe and on earth and what life meant. And those moments were wonderful, you know, as you looked out the window and, you know, you would look into the nothingness of Kazakhstan for 4 days. I mean, it's just nothing. It's just flat. And so, yes, you had killer playlists. You had playlists that we thought were killer. And then by the end of the trip, we were like, oh my God, I don't want to hear this song ever again. And sometimes the navigating when you got to a city, I think it's getting quote unquote there is always a three-stage process. There is physically traveling from one city to another. And that's stage one. And when you think it's over, it's okay, where are we going to stay and where are we going to park? And those last two points just suck all the energy out of you because you're where you need to be, but you don't know the streets. You can't read the street signs. And so that's when it gets pretty hairy and arguments happen in the car. You know, where are we going? You're supposed to be the navigator. And so that was tough after a 12 or 13 hour day.
And how did your noble chariot stand up to this punishment? Because last time I looked on a list of cars to have to take off-roading or 4x4ing or whatever else, and trust me, my friend, I have the worst car karma in Europe. My cars are always breaking down. How did your car perform?
You know, I do have to give three cheers to the Japanese because this thing was unbelievable. We sheared an engine mount bolt in Germany. It's probably the best country to have automotive problems. And that was, we were able to solve that problem. Other than that, this car only got one flat tire and we never changed the oil after almost 10,000 miles. So she sounded like a muscle car by the end. She was gargling and, you know, was screaming for some help, but she got us there and without too much mechanical fanfare.
And what about the other competitors and the organizers themselves? Did you have checkpoints? Did you see other guys? Were you swapping war stories about getting out of this town or that town across this border?
Yeah, you know, everything kind of, there were two bottleneck points. One was Istanbul, because, you know, all roads kind of lead there when going from Europe to Asia. And then the other one was the bottleneck from Russia into Mongolia. So we started to see many, many more cars as everyone funneled into Mongolia. And then there, it was a lot of sharing war stories, asking if you'd like to be in our convoy, you know, all that kind of stuff. Much safer when you travel in two, three, or four. And that's when it became really fun. Mongolia was really a glorious time, as maniacal as the roads could be. But we found a great convoy of about three or four cars, and you camped together, you helped each other out. When the other cars broke down, you helped when you can. You took the football out, the soccer ball, kicked it around, and just enjoyed, I don't know, the middle of nowhere.
A very good friend of mine is a freelance cameraman, and he came back from Mongolia saying, you've got to go because the scenery is like anything you'll ever see.
It's honestly, I've never been to Mars, but Western Mongolia is worth the price of admission. It is truly, truly mind-bending. You seem like you're in Narnia, like you left a world and entered another. So it's a place to see for sure.
It would have been a boy's own story with just the travel and getting to Ulaanbaatar, which is always my Trivial Pursuit winning question, by the way. If anybody asks what the capital of Mongolia is, I reel that so-and-so off since I was about 13 years old. Trust me on this one. But you know, you look at this a little bit differently because of what you do, and the journey is only part of getting there. But the people and thinking of why you're doing it and what you learn about who you are, and where we are in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also just a lesson in relativity, right? All the problems we have or the things we complain about in life, when you see that most of the world has less than you. I mean, it is a humbling experience, and yet they smile more than I do. And that was always a very humbling situation. And I would say just the kindness of strangers is something more than you can ever prepare for. And that was something that still, it sticks with me to this day, that there are people along the way who helped us, who really didn't have to go out of their way. And they did it with such joy. That is really what the rally is about, right? Taking yourself out of your comfort zone, being vulnerable, learning about the world and other cultures, and understanding that, hey, we're all on the same rock spinning through space. And let me try to be a little more understanding.
I mean, I spoke to Charlie, but I've interviewed Charlie Borman, who did the long way around with Ewan McGregor. And he said that, you know, the thing is that people, you know, despite what you might think about them, and you may have this stereotypical thing about the world, is actually, you know, people will help you out if they need to. And basically, it restored his faith in humanity.
Absolutely. I would say 99.9% of people want to live a decent life. They want to work hard. They want a better life for their children. They want a roof, some food, and a little bit of leisure. And I think the media is so quick, you know, we point the light at the people not doing lovely things. And so every story you heard, no matter where you were, was one of help. And yes, obviously there were some bandits, there were some times that we had that were not so enjoyable, but for the most part, the outpouring of kindness was really something. And one of the things I remember people saying, we didn't go through Iran, but I heard from multiple groups of people that said the people in Iran were the nicest people ever. There were stories of people literally giving clothes off of their back to people, paying for car repairs. And the ralliers were like, how do I pay you back? Do you have PayPal or whatever? They said, don't worry about it. Like, just go have fun, enjoy your journey. And I don't know if that would happen in the States, to be honest, or I don't even know if I would do that. And that kind of bothered me. So it was always a lesson in I can be a little bit better.
You've kind of done this thing before with the trekking and the you know, the Kilimanjaro and the film fest as well, the nomading, yeah, film festival. One of the things that strikes me is, and you said, it says in the press notes, it's about the kind of adventures we all said we have one day and never do it. If anybody's thinking about doing something completely crazy like this, or would seem to be, presumably you would say, listen, go and do it. Don't worry, you know, worry, the bank balance will still be there when you get back. The house, the mortgage will still be there when you get back, but you'll have the experiences and the basic faith about who we are.
Exactly. I remember my grandfather, my opa in Holland, who lived, had some stories of World War II, et cetera. I asked him, I said, opa, what's your advice in life? This is when I was 18. And he put his hands on my shoulder and said, live an interesting life. No one wants to talk to an old man with no stories to tell. And that's really it, right? I mean, and I think in this world, we're so public. Everything is out there. We want it to be perfect. We want to prepare and plan and make sure that we succeed on every first go. But that's not what exploration is. It's, as I remember, someone said, your experience in this life cannot exceed your willingness to be vulnerable. So in order to get from London to Ulaanbaatar or to trek a mountain or to start a business or a project, you got to be vulnerable. You got to be willing to put yourself out there. But the rewards you get on the other side, my goodness, it's worth every penny and every moment of stress.
What was the feeling like when you turned the engine off in Ulaanbaatar?
You know, it was a bittersweet. I talk a bit about that in the book, how it was this quest to get there. Oh, we got to get there. We got to get there. We got to get to Ulaanbaatar. And then it was the quintessential wait. The there wasn't the point. It was really the journey. So I think there was, I've never anthropomorphized the car before,
yep.
But I loved that thing. I really, really did. And she got us there. So it was a little bit of sadness. And I think while we were all together in that car, we were still quote unquote on the rally. We were still what I call latter-day barbarians. And once the engine turned off and we went to our hotel in Ulaanbaatar, the rally was now behind us. This was now in the past. It was now a memory. And yeah, there was this sense of we never wanted to let it go, while at the same time wanting some creature comforts that we didn't have. So for me, it really did check all the boxes. I had the feeling of I never wanted it to end, but I was ready for it to end at the same time. So bittersweet, I would say, bittersweet to end.
When I did the Google whack thing and to just to find and you know to find out who you are, because this is what we do, you know, and this sort of thing.
Exactly.
Quite a few things came up when you pop in your name, but there's a couple of great quotes that come, and the one that springs to mind is, the only thing you can really control is how you react to things out of your control. This rally must have brought that home in spades.
Absolutely. You know, and that was my point before. I think we try so hard in this life to make everything perfect and we want to know how it's all going to work out. But really, what are the things we can control? It's how we react to the things out of our control. And that's what I think makes us who we are, right? In those moments, how are we going to react? And it's really not about your plan. Like, I don't think anything happens for a reason. I think things happen. And then you define that reason. You define how you're going to react when that thing's handed to you. So yes, when you say it was handed to us in spades, every single day we had a plan and every single day it didn't go the way we wanted it to. And yet you just had to figure it out. So our motto was just eat and move east. If we ate and moved east every day, that was deemed successful. However we got there in whatever northeasterly or southeasterly route didn't matter. We were succeeding.
And the other thing is, and that's a very noble thing. It's a very spiritual program and the whole thing with a quote. But the other thing that comes up when you Google your name is baby wipes. So I'm very sorry, but
yeah,
just give us some of, if you're going to go on a long journey like that, baby wipes, absolutely the first thing on the list.
They weren't the first thing on our list, but I had chatted with someone who went on a rally before and she said, baby wipes. And I said the same thing. What am I missing here? And she said, most of the time in the middle of nowhere, you're going to the bathroom in the desert and you're digging a hole. So there's that. And secondly, once you get kind of east of Azerbaijan, it is just dust and sand in your car everywhere. And so you have basically caked dirt all over you all the time. And when you're camping for 6 days straight, there's no showers. So you got to clean yourself somehow. And those baby wipes clean the car. They clean you. I don't know. It just feels, there's something about a baby wipe that just feels, I don't know, as if you're actually cleaning yourself as you're really probably not doing much at that moment.
The press notes say what it means to be human whilst covered in a constant sheen of ore and grime.
That's right. That's right.
The book is called Borders, Bandits and Baby Wipes, A Big Adventure in a Tiny Car. It's by Bassam Tarasi. Bassam, if people want to find out more about you and about the book itself, the book itself is available as a download at the Talk Radio Europe virtual bookstore. Do you do the social media thing? How can they get in touch and
yes,
find out more?
I do. I think the easiest way, obviously I don't have an easy first name, but my website is just myfirstname.com. So B as in boy, A-S-S-A, M as in Michael.com. There you'll find everything about me. There's not many Bassam Tarazis in the world. So if you Google me, I'm probably the one that pops up. So Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff. It's my first and last name.
Absolutely. And, you've done a variety of amazing things. I think we can all probably dream to do them. What are you up to next?
You know, that is a wonderful question. I got married in early 2017. So as I talk about in the book, the Hellcat in me is slowly dying, not in the sense of losing my curiosity, but trekking I've always just been brought back to the mountains somehow, some way. So I'm always I'm looking for that next peak. That I think is next on my list. I had the pleasure of going to Antarctica, about a year ago, and that was the seventh continent, and that kind of tidied things up for me on an explorer's note. That was an amazing place. So I'm figuring out what the next challenge will be, but it'll probably be on a mountain somewhere.
Well, if you fancy coming to a mountain somewhere in Spain, let us know. We'll be glad to give you a lift in one of our TRE vehicles, and we might even be able to lend you a tent. The book is called Borders, Bandits and Baby Wipes, A Big Adventure in a Tiny Car. Bassam Tarasi, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, sir. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it tremendously.
This is Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.